Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
In celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Frankfurt School, it's a great pleasure and honor to have two very special guests here on our philosophy program. We are happy to have Gayatri Spivak. She is one of the most important philosophers of our time. Her work has greatly advanced deconstructivist, feminist and post-colonial theory. She has influenced academic and public debates around the world, and now we have her on the line. A very warm welcome to you, Gayatri Spivak.
Thank you for asking me.
And we are also very happy to have Amy Allen. She is professor of philosophy and women's gender and sexuality studies at Pennsylvania State University. Her work addresses different notions of power and attempts to bridge post-structuralist theory and critical theory. She has developed an important critique of the younger Frankfurt School critical theory, challenging its implicit Eurocentrism. A very warm welcome to you, Amy Allen.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this is the third conversation in a series of three trying to figure out whether and how Frankfurt School critical theory is still relevant. And we have already discussed the notions of critique and of reason. So now we want to turn to the question, how can we think progress today? Is it even possible saving this notion? So let's just jump in at the deep end, Gayatri Spivak. What do you think? Is there progress in the world?
I actually did the usual research that we do these days, that is to say, Googled the word, and I found out that at the end of the 17th century, it became obsolete in British English, and it was readopted in the early 19th century from American English. And I think this already tells us the story of progress. You know, I very much like Amy Allen's work, and I do think that she also notices the connection between the passage of imperialism from Europe to the United States and the Frankfurt School hanging in there, criticizing this, but in a Eurocentric way. So I would say that it's not something that we can just avoid. You know, it's something like moving forward, fortschritt, is going to take place. It's not as to whether we are moving forward in a good direction or a bad direction is what we think about. Now, what I would like to say in praise of Amy's work is that it is very, very important to decolonize the discipline of philosophy, which is where I put Allen's work. And I think it's very good in asking for minority voices. They should certainly be heard in the discipline. But my problem is not Eurocentrism. My problem today is not even with what we call progress or fortschritt. Those are English and German words. My problem is with the North in the South and the South in the North. We are not neatly divided into Europe and the rest of the world, have not been for quite some time. We are, in fact, globally all mixed up. And so, although I very much agree that the discipline should be cleared up, my focus is really on the millions and millions and millions of people in the world, right at the bottom, who are in the margins of history, who are being developed. So it's a kind of synonym for progress, development. You will find that the two words are used synonymously a good deal in the world of policymaking. Now, the policymakers are mostly not reading Axel Honneth or Habermas or the Frankfurt School. The policymakers, in fact, are going forward in the interest of A, keeping those millions of people, the lowest, the bottommost part of the world, uneducated so that they will be democracy as body count and vote for tyrants. See, this particular problem, even as the development lobby constantly says, you know, World Health Organization, the World Bank, etc., we must work with the community. They consider the world's wealth of languages as an inconvenience. Now, the thing is that in order to be able to think about the unavoidable idea of fortune, development, progress, etc., we really have to, because I'm also an activist and have been working in these areas now for 40 years or more. And so I would say that in today's context, when we are really being run by a greater planetary narrative with climate change, where human accountability is way short of trivial, I think what we need to be doing is looking at how the notion of development translates for all of these people in many, 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 many ways. It's a collective work rather than just simply writing books to improve the discipline, although that is also extremely necessary and we must have minority voices. So therefore, I would say that my real problem is with policy making. My real problem is with progress as development, which is really just insertion into the circuit of capital without any subject formation or any attention even to the relationship between language and understanding of development. So I'm sorry to take it away from just decolonizing the discipline, because I don't really, I will say with great respect, I don't take the idea of decolonizing as a possibility in the current world. Decolonizing would happen through regulating capital, and we've gone beyond regulation. Also, the notion of decolonizing is a little bit behind now, it seems to me. And I think rather than confront Eurocentrism, we ought to be confronting not only the globalized world where North and South are all mixed up, but also go back to look at the fact that imperialism could come into being because there was always collaboration. So to an extent, it's the autocritical moment which can make our practice stronger. That's where I would go, and remembering that today we're being played by planetarity rather than just undertaking critical theory or critique. Yeah. Or reason.
You have now introduced lots of interesting and complex ideas, I think. And before we should have a closer look at the critique of your critique, Amy Allen, of the philosophy of Frankfurt School, we should maybe hear how you see things on a practical level. Is there progress in the world in your eyes? Can we find progress, and how can we find it?
Well, first of all, I want to say what an honor it is to have this three-way conversation with Gayatri Spivak, and to have the chance to have her compliment my work is really quite lovely. So I'm grateful for that. I guess, you know, whether or not we can find instances of progress all depends on how we're going to define what counts as progress. So, I mean, my interest in my book, The End of Progress, was about thinking about different ways of identifying normative benchmarks for progress and, you know, trying to kind of preserve a certain aspect of the concept of progress while at the same time cutting it down to size and moving away from the more grand narratives of European modernity as an instance of progress that I think are still underwriting the projects of Habermas and some of his followers. So I don't think it's difficult to find instances of what we want to call progress around us, and of regress as well, unfortunately. But, you know, it all depends on how we're going to identify what counts as progress. And for me, that has to be a much more kind of contextual and local and historically specific and in some sense more contingent judgment than I think some of the followers in the Frankfurt School are comfortable with.
Well, the philosophers of the Frankfurt School feel committed to an immanent form of critique, to a historical way of justifying the standards of critique, aren't they? And so they operate with a very strong concept of progress. In this perspective, the formation of modern society and its development in the last 250 years have to be explained within the framework of progress and regression. So where exactly do you see the pitfalls of this concept of progress, Amy, Alan?
I mean, I think there are two sorts of problems. One is really more of a conceptual problem, which is, you know, I think that the strategy of using a strong concept of historical progress to justify the normative project comes in as an attempt to avoid, on the one hand, a kind of strong foundationalism that critical theory says, you know, they want to move beyond because we want to have a more historicized understanding of reason and of normativity. But on the other hand, they also are really concerned, I think maybe overly concerned, about the specter of relativism. And so that's, as I try to argue, that's how they land on this strategy of grounding the normative perspective of critical theory in a progressive reading of history. It sort of steps in to fill this role in between foundationalism and relativism. And one sort of problem is a kind of conceptual problem, because it's not really clear to me that that's ultimately a stable view. I mean, in the sense that I think it either ends up kind of implicitly appealing to some kind of supra-historical and therefore transcendent kind of standard in order to justify its claim that what it calls progress actually is progress. Or, on the other hand, it ends up kind of falling back into the sort of contextualism that it's striving to avoid. So that's the conceptual problem. And then the political problem, I mean, I think Gayatri Spivak has already mentioned it. I mean, it's the way that notions of progress, or not just the concept of progress, I mean, but the particular story of European modernity as a progressive historical development is really tightly bound up with these ideas of development, of civilizational advance, et cetera, that, you know, I think underpin a lot of pernicious colonial, neocolonial, imperialist, neo-imperialist ideologies, but also are, you know, living on in somewhat maybe less obvious ways in various languages and practices of development. So I think there are two problems. One's more conceptual, one's more, you might say, political, but they're connected.
Yeah. Thank you. Gayatri Spivak, your name is closely connected to the concept of the subaltern. You introduced this concept in your famous essay, Can the Subaltern Speak?, published in 1988. And in very broad terms, subaltern persons are in a social and epistemic position in which they cannot make themselves heard and acknowledged by powerful groups, by the ones who decisively influence the social and political realm. So can you explain to us a bit, who are these subaltern today? And do you see a relation between the possibility of progress and their chance to be heard and acknowledged? Or in other words, in what way are they maybe even victims of progress?
Okay, yes, that's a very important question. And I would first say that, you see, the work of the Frankfurt School is tremendously important. And we certainly teach, I specifically teach Adorno the most, but it's also true that it's 100 years old. So to an extent, Amy, you must forgive me, but this is a general kind of sense of things. See, when we are in Asia, as I often am, you know, we're thinking China, Korea, Japan, India, and so on, we don't really think Europe a lot. So this European modernity seems to us almost a legitimation of Europe by reversal, to be against European modernity. Within the so-called Asian century, we really look autocritically at ourselves rather than follow that line. It's an important issue, but it's not, I mean, we felt rightly or wrongly that for historical and political reasons, the Frankfurt School had to rise and the subject of Marxism moved from the working class to the intellectual. So that's a very broad generalization. Forgive me, but I had to get that said. It's good that you in Germany are so focused on it. It's an important moment, but we think of it as more parochial rather than what's happening in the world today. Now, the word subaltern is taken from Antonio Gramsci, and he has a very neat definition, and that's the one we use, engendering it. Of course, that's our contribution. His definition is small social groups, not class. They haven't come into class yet. Small social groups in the margins of history. So that this is the definition, Notebook 29. So that when we go into history, you know, as, for example, discussing the Frankfurt School, when we do not, in fact, bring these voices into the outlining of history. And within this group, progress would be understanding that democracy is other people, because there, as I said at the beginning, in most of the countries of the world, their votes are used. The subaltern today, as they didn't in Gramsci's lifetime, the subaltern votes. They are democracy as arithmetic, body count. They must not realize that democracy is other people. The subaltern, this group, because they're in the margins of history, they have no access to citizenship. They are only used for voting and nothing else. And some top-down philanthropy, I'm talking about absolutely the bottom layer, not way below the NGO radar. And there, I think, what I've been doing, and since the subaltern is by definition not generalizable, I have been running these schools, teaching and training in my native language, but regional. Now, the elections are completely covered in violence, and I don't read about them in books. I know these people. So they are my text. This is not practical versus theoretical. The practical stuff, so-called, norms theory, when at the end of the day, when I'm doing the work, it's like I'm thrown into water, somehow trying to swim, trying to learn how to access cognitive instruments destroyed by us. You see, colonialism is young. And in fact, funnily enough, some of the colonials, the missionaries and so on, they treated these people better than we did. We treated them like animals. And the caste system is thousands of years old. So to an extent, in globality, that's what I was trying to say, we have to recognize that in globality, we can't just say colonialism was bad, let's decolonize. In globality, we see the old structures of ethnic prejudice, corruption and power, collaboration, theocracy in India, all these longue durée structures coming back when the post-colonial varnish has worn off, because they were very bourgeois-directed, progressive bourgeoisie, to quote Lenin. So it seems to me that that's where the subaltern is. The subaltern runs the world as body count voting, so the tyrants are elected all over the world.
There's an interesting point of intersection here, because you were just saying that the subaltern positions do not even have the means to make themselves heard. And you, Amy Allen, you have worked a lot on knowledge and the finding that the very foundation of Western knowledge, of knowledge as such, are pervaded by imperialist assumptions, maybe even some kind of class assumptions. So we might bring these things together and bring up the question, how do these two things correlate? Can we maybe not hear subaltern positions because our very foundations of knowledge are influenced by a subtle self-conception of superiority, of Western superiority? And if so, can you, Amy Allen, give us an example of how this might be working?
Well, yes, thank you for that question, because it allows me to go back to something that Gayatri said at the beginning of her last answer, which is about auto-critique. I mean, I think I understand the my project on progress to be a kind of auto-critique of the Frankfurt School tradition or something like this. I mean, an internal, imminent critique of its own self-understanding, let's say. And I think in, for example, Habermas's work, that his work is animated by a really laudable and important goal of engaging in a broad, let's say, intercultural, you know, universal dialogue around questions of justice and so on. But it seems to me that the way that the story of progress, you know, reading history in terms of a progressive development is propping up his own normative project actually makes it difficult to carry out that dialogue in the kind of truly open and egalitarian fashion that he claims. So the other thing I wanted to say in response to your question, Simone, is mm-hmm. that it brings up for me the issue of standpoint theory and the way that standpoint impacts our own understanding. And I think one of the core insights of standpoint theory and standpoint epistemology that I take to be true and important to keep in mind, and one that I think maybe has not always been fully recognized in the contemporary Frankfurt School theorists, is that those who are oppressed and marginalized really do have a better understanding of oppression and how oppression functions than those who are privileged. And that it's important to keep in mind, as the feminist Marxist standpoint theorist Nancy Hartsock put it once, domination when viewed from above looks like equality. And that's really the challenge, I think, for people who are trying to theorize from a position of relative privilege, is to understand how what looks like equality from that point of view might be experienced by those who are marginalized and oppressed as a domination. So in that sense, the project of a kind of auto-critique, it certainly doesn't get us everything that we need in terms of changing the world and making it a more just, less oppressive place. But I think it's an important place to begin, and also important in helping Frankfurt School critical theory to live up to its own critical ambitions and critical self-understanding.
Yeah, thank you. And can I add one question here? Because the title of your book, The End of Progress, refers to a quote from Adorno. Adorno wrote in the 60s that progress occurs only where it has ended. And on the surface, this sounds paradoxical, doesn't it? So why do you think that this idea of progress, hindering progress, is a productive idea? And what exactly is it that has to be stopped in order to open up the possibility of progress in a correctly understood way in your eyes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I do take inspiration for that quote from Adorno, but I intended it not quite in the way that he meant it. I mean, the impulse or the idea that I borrow from Adorno, although I see it in other theorists as well, is the idea of trying to disentangle what I call the backward-looking, you know, historical conception of progress as a reading of history in terms of development and progressive direction and so on, from a more forward-looking aspiration of progress as a hope, as, you know, as an aspiration for how we might improve our lives. So it's that idea of kind of breaking apart the conception of progress that I want to take from Adorno and use it as a way of pushing back, I think, against the much more cumulative conception of progress that I think is at work in both Habermas and Honneth. And I would also say to some extent in Rahel Yagi's work mm-hmm. on progress, which is different in some ways, but does very much assume this kind of cumulative process, you know, of progress that I think the Adorno idea allows us to kind of call into question. And so I try to take that in the direction of saying, you know, progress in terms of unlearning the lessons of a certain reading of European modernity and actually learning to listen. This is a point I wanted to come back to. You know, I think from the point of view of auto-critique or thinking of an imminent critique of the Frankfurt School, you know, which, I mean, it's not always being practiced by people from positions of privilege, but, you know, I would count myself as a white American, as someone who is trying to engage in a project of critical theory from a position of a lot of privilege, that the aim is figuring out how to hear, actually, figuring out how to listen to the voices of the oppressed and the marginalized, you know, and that takes me back to the standpoint idea. So the idea is, you know, we could only really make progress in a forward-looking sense if we can figure out how to unlearn some of the problematic postures, let's say, lack of epistemic humility that the story of historical progress leaves us with.
So Gayatri Spivak, can you relate to this idea of progress as a forward-looking conception and hope? Can you relate to this idea?
Well, hope is always very important. Hope, although you have no hope of that hope ever being fulfilled, it's a very important attitude to have. I certainly can agree with that. But I would say that, you know, I don't think that the subaltern... I wrote Can the Subaltern Speak long, long ago, and even there I wasn't saying that the subaltern could not be heard because of imperialism. Because, in fact, the story there was that a woman had tried to resist the terrible ideas behind widow burning, and that had nothing to do with colonialism, widow burning that was relating one woman to one man alone, passing of property, legitimacy, etc. She had tried to break it. She was in the anti-imperialist struggle, and when she was given an assassination detail, she couldn't kill, so she killed herself, as was the rule. But she waited 4 days to menstruate and wrote a letter also to her sister, who was my grandmother, saying that, you know, why she was hanging herself. And she was menstruating when she hanged herself so that no one would think it was an illicit pregnancy. But in two generations, my first cousin, an eminent philosopher, said, and she's still writing philosophy books, and she's a wonderful friend of mine, asked me why I was interested in this family scandal of the woman who hanged herself because of an illicit pregnancy. And I said, in rage, the subaltern cannot speak, because she had taken such good care to show that she was resisting the idea that a woman only killed herself because of one man. And another woman in the family, very, very well educated, couldn't hear her. So this had really nothing to do with colonialism at all. Widow burning, in fact, the British made it criminal. So therefore, and I was trying to escape from being just an authority on French philosophy. See, so that this idea that European philosophies can change the world and have hope, etc., for us is a parochial idea. Mm-hmm. So in fact, the autocritique was not directed at Europe, because what I did right after publishing that piece was move into this other area, in 84 already, moved into this other area of producing the subaltern intellectual. So I started working for them. And I think I agree with Amy that you must learn to listen and hear. But the thing is that I don't publish stuff about this work, because if I tried to decode it for other academics, then I would not be able to listen. It's not so easy. I've been making mistakes and learning from these mistakes and making mistakes again, because these cognitive machines, and in non-generalizable ways, I'm talking practice and theory together, in non-generalizable ways, they've been ruined, not by colonialism. Colonialism for us is a historical movement contained for 500 years, and it is contained within a much larger history of corruption, power, collaboration, etc., in the whole world. And in globality, those old structures are coming back. Ethnic prejudice, in my country, theocracy, the idea of establishing through trade, some kind of globality, etc. Those I just talked about China, Africa, and India. These things are coming back, and they really have nothing to do with specifically the history of European colonialism. So we can't hear the subaltern because we cannot work with those ruined cognitive machines. In my case, for example, I work with caste, not with colonialism. And within the caste system, who ruined these subalterns? We did. I'm a caste Hindu. I did. So that to an extent, to understand this today in the global context, collaborative power, not located in Europe necessarily, and the hope will not come from Europe necessarily. It's a parochial debate. Germany is not going to solve it, and Britain is not going to solve it. The United States, for sure, is not going to solve it. So therefore, that's where I'm at, the idea of the global context and how we learn to listen, working with small groups of subalterns in a decentralized fashion, taking advantage of the structure put in place through the international civil society and turning it against itself, not accusing it or excusing it, but turning it against itself so that we can use that structure for this kind of, as it were, universal teacher training, so that children of the very poor, subaltern children, can perhaps grow up understanding that democracy is other people. You see, I think we give up European modernity at a great risk. What we have to do is take European modernity and defang it and show that European modernity actually failed in its own context, and then save what is savable in there and run with it. Because if you really consider the world as such, it's a very frightening idea that we would throw that away. So that's how I talk global, not by saying imperialism ruined us. I'm asking us to do affirmative sabotage with that bürgerlich stuff that imperialism gave.
Amy Allen, so, do you want to respond to that? What are your ideas on the question of what we have to unlearn in order to be capable of listening and understanding what subaltern positions speak about?
I totally agree with you that the point is not to throw out all of European modernity. And I mean, I don't even know what that would mean, honestly. I think the idea of, you know, what you called affirmative sabotage and trying to rethink, you know, turn the structures against themselves in a subversive direction makes a lot of sense. So I don't take the point of the critique of Eurocentrism to mean we throw the entire Enlightenment project out the window or something like that. We have to be careful not to throw the baby of all of Enlightenment thought out with the bathwater of Eurocentrism. So I'm in agreement with you on that. And also, I take your point about the relative importance of the longer history of caste in India versus the relatively short history of colonialism. I mean, I think just in the interest of a kind of auto-critique and continual learning on my own part, I would say with my book about progress, one of the things I'm least satisfied about with that book is, you know, a kind of undifferentiated account of, you know, colonialism and imperialism that doesn't differentiate enough different contexts and that doesn't really talk about settler colonialism at all, which is, of course, still not in any way past in the United States, but, you know, still structures all of property relations and life in an ongoing way. So that's just to say, I think that one of the problems I see now with my approach in that book is that it sort of lumps a lot of things in together as a way of kind of launching this critique of the idea of progress in the Frankfurt School that really need to be much more carefully differentiated. But again, I mean, the project, I suppose, in that book is rather limited in the sense that it's really trying to engage in a kind of imminent critique of the project, certain approaches to normativity in the Frankfurt School, with the interest of opening that tradition up to more engagement with other, let's say, global critical theories or progressive theories. I think I had the sense that a lot of the debates had become a little bit insular and that there wasn't a vibrant debate within the Frankfurt School around issues of neocolonialism, imperialism, racism, and that it seemed to me that there was something about the role that the idea of progress plays in that tradition was kind of an impediment to that kind of conversation. But it's that broader conversation that I think Gayatri is really pushing in this conversation, and I completely agree that that's very important.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we have to come to an end very soon. So as a last and short point, let's look ahead. What do you hope for regarding not only the further development of critical theory, but in particular the subsequent social and political developments on this planet? In very short words, what are your hopes, Gayatri and then Amy?
My hope is going back to the idea that democracy is not just liberty, but also equality. It's other people's children as my children. That idea travels from the subaltern to the elite. Theorists might say, well, that's too biopolitical. But the trouble is that biopolitics runs the world. And so my hope is that this idea, we will be able to spread generation after generation so that the emphasis on greed will change. Control greed through this idea.
Amy?
Well, in terms of Frankfurt School and critical theory, I feel very, I would say, hopeful and optimistic about the future of that as a project. And I feel that way because I see my own graduate students and many other graduate students and younger, you know, early career scholars who are finding a lot of resources within the tradition. I mean, I would say Gayatri mentioned Adorno earlier as, you know, someone that she teaches frequently. And I find that a number of my students who are interested in thinking about race, about indigenous politics, about capitalism, imperialism, that they're very drawn to the early Frankfurt School, to Adorno in particular. And of course, we haven't really talked about Marx, but there's a huge kind of resurgence of interest in Marx and Marxism in the last 10 years, 15 years in conversations in Frankfurt School critical theory. And I think bringing the critique of capitalism back into the center of the conversation is really hugely important. So all of that strikes me as good developments and as evidence of critical theory kind of recovering some of the best features of its, you know, of the first generation, and also opening out to other critical traditions, to Black critical thought, to feminist thought, to indigenous political thought, and so on, in ways that are really promising. In terms of the planet, I think I hope for a kind of Adornian notion of progress as the avoidance of catastrophe.
Thank you so much, Gayatri Spivak and Amy Allen, for this inspiring conversation. I wish you all the very best.
Thank you so much for having me.